Welcome to episode number 15 of the Board Game OK podcast, a podcast about board games and the hobby of board gaming, recorded in hot and sweaty Helsinki, Finland. I'm your co-host Jonas, and with me is my co-host Luis.
Yeah, very sweaty, but hello everyone.
In today's episode, me and Luis will discuss winning and losing and how the goal of winning affects other people at the table. But before we get to that, we will talk about Regicide, The Anarchy, and Scott Abray. Luis, why don't you talk to us about Regicide?
All right, Jonas. Regicide is a cooperative game from 2020, designed by Paul Abrahams, Luke Badger, and Andy Richdale. I think there was another designer for the solo variation, but I don't really know how it affects, or maybe it was like combining the Regicide legacy part, because researching for the basic Regicide is these three designers at least. So sorry if I'm missing the solo person there. Regicide is a cooperative card game designed for 1-4 players, playable with a standard deck of cards. But the 2020 version that I'm talking about came out with like a specific deck of cards with designs for, or with a specific design for this game and with like the printed rules. But you can also print the rules online and just play it with any standard deck of cards. The version that I have is the blue one. I think there's a red version and it's very nicely themed. It has like characters of different races of a fantasy D&D game, kind of a role-play game. So it's a very nice version. If you want to play this game, if you like this game, even if you play it with a normal deck of cards, it's nice to have like the special version because it adds, in my opinion, some theme to the game. And the game theme centers in a realm where the leadership has been corrupted or has been taken over by some evil power, or they just have been corrupted themselves to like the point where like it's time to rebel, right? The player's objective is to defeat all of the corrupt leadership. And these are represented by the high number by the face cards, the jacks, the queens, and the kings. And you have to defeat them in ascending difficulty. So you will always defeat first all of the jacks, then all of the queens, and then all of the kings. These are shuffled independently, so you don't know exactly which jack you're going to play against, but you know that you will play against all the jacks first before moving to the queens and before moving to the kings. The gameplay is very simple. In your turn, you just choose a card to attack with, and you will attack the enemy that you're facing with the attack power of the value of the card, which is you play a 7 of hearts, you will be dealing 7 damage to that player. Then the enemy will counterattack you with an attack power of, depending on the suit or depending on the face card, it'll be 10, 15, or 20, depending if it's a jack, a queen, or a king. And you have to defend yourself with a total number of the value of the cards that equals or surpasses this number. So if you get attacked by 10, then you have to discard a total of 10. It could be a 10 card, or it can be a 3 and a 7, or a 6 and a 4. Or if you cannot make it exact, you can go over. You can be a 6 and a 5, or 2 sevens, or whatever. The point of the game is just to basically defeat all of them before you getting defeated yourself. You get defeated if at any point any of the players cannot defend against an attack from an enemy. That is very simple what you do in the game. Obviously, there is some caveats and some twists and turns to this, which make the game quite special. The first thing is that each suit has a special power. So depending on the card that you play, you will activate the power of that suit. So at the start of the game, you have a hand of cards, let's say, depending on the number of players, let's say it's 6. When you play a card, you will have only 5 the next time, and then you will have to defend with a certain number of cards. You will not redraw any cards unless you play a diamond. The diamond's power is that when you play it, you can draw cards back from the main deck. Consequently, the other suits have different powers. The hearts is what allows you to reshuffle cards from the discard pile back into the draw deck. So you can already imagine that, for example, there will be a point where if you don't pay attention enough to the hearts, you want to draw more cards, but then there's no more cards on the draw deck because you didn't use the hearts well enough. And then the black suits are more about power. The clubs are doubling the attack power that you have, and the spades are reducing the attack power of your enemy. So every suit has a special power. The second twist of the game is that you can combine some suits. Like if you have the ace, if you combine any card with an ace, you're adding a 1 from the ace, and you're also adding the power of the other suit or of the ace's suit. And you can always, by default, you can always play only one card, but you can always combine an 8. The third thing you can do is like, if it's a very small number, like a 2 or a 3, you can combine multiple of these numbers as long as the total value does not surpass 10. So let's say you can combine two twos or four twos or three threes or two fours. And then again, you add the numbers and you're also combining the two different suit powers. And the third and last trick of the game, which makes this game fantastic, is that each one of your enemies will defend against its own suit. So it will block your power. So if you are having a jack of diamonds and you try to play a diamond, you will not redraw any cards because the jack of diamonds is blocking that. If you have queen of clubs and you try to attack with a club, then your damage will not be doubled. And so on and so forth. There is a joker which you can add with higher player counts, or you can add if the game is too difficult for you, which alters a little bit these mechanics. But in essence, that's pretty much what you do. And thematically, I think when you defeat a person, it goes to your discard pile. And thematically,
what do you call these people? People. These are monarchs, dictators, tyrants.
Okay, when you defeat this is what I'm trying to get at. When you defeat these monarchs or tyrants, but they're actually people, they go into your discard pile, which potentially can shuffle back into your deck, which means can come into your hand, which thematically it means that you have defeated the corruption in them, and now they're aiding you to defeat the corruption of the realm. So they were not really bad people. They were just either misguided or have been cursed or taken over by an evil entity. And as soon as you defeat them, they are like, oh, their mind clears, and then they're back to the good players' camp. So for sure, I think it's surprisingly thematic if you think about it that way. Obviously, the game, you're just playing cards and fighting and then receiving attack and then whatever you lose or not. But you are defeating the evil curse of the realm. And at some point, you defeat the last king, which I assume is not never going to come to your party because the game's over.
Yeah, so. Sucks to be the last king. Yeah. Because you're the one who gets killed.
The last king, he gets killed for real. It's the sacrifice to the realm for the realm to survive ever after. But everybody else potentially can be a good person. And that's it. The game ends either in victory if you defeat everyone, or as soon as one of the players, doesn't have to be all of the players, as soon as one of the players cannot defend, the game's over. And it's surprisingly tricky to achieve. I've played this game over 30 times, and I still lose. You would think that after it's so many times, you can manage the game, but it does affect, the luck affects a little bit. Also, if you're playing with new players, I guess getting the intricacies of or the probability of getting a card that will mess up your game later on, it's harder to internalize the first few plays. So if you're playing with new players, most of the time, it's harder to win. Also, it's easier to win with two people than with four people. Four people, I think, is the hardest to win. But yeah, that's Regicide. Have you played this game, Jon?
I have played it. I have played it with Chilla, and we used a normal deck of cards. Oh yeah, and then later on, I have also played it solo because I really wanted to see if I could win the game. As I mentioned in the previous episode, I feel like the solo version is much easier to compare to the multiplayer version. And I can see how it gets even more difficult with three or four players.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much more coordination that you need to do with others, right?
Yeah.
No one can have a bad turn.
Yeah.
Right? Because in Pandemic, you can still let someone to do their own little thing, even if it's not the most optimal thing, you know? But in here, if someone that has a bad turn, well, that's the end of the game. They just get killed.
Yeah. Yeah. And also luck matters, and the communication. If you're playing with new players, maybe you reduce the limitations a little bit so it's easier. But you're not supposed to say anything. You're not supposed to say hey, let me kill them, or don't attack them, or I'll manage them, or whatever. You're not supposed to talk about anything in your hand, which can indeed make other people make mistakes that are we're done.
I had totally forgotten about this communication limit. And yeah, now I remember that challenge of really having to pay attention to how many cards the other person has in their hand and how many cards do they have in the draw deck.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you're going to have to really look at your own cards and think about okay, do we need to deal a lot of damage now, or do we need to have the special effect go off?
Yeah. Yeah. And everybody has to kind of be in sync in order to play properly. And yeah, sometimes you just play a wrong card thinking that your companion still has a diamond so that you can redraw, and nobody has a diamond, and then the game is over. Or you have a diamond and then the queen of diamonds comes next, and then you cannot use the diamond power. The joker is the only thing that can allow to communicate a little bit, where you can be like, hey, let me go next. Or people can be like, hey, I can go next, let me go next. Other than that, you're supposed to, if I remember correctly, because I haven't read the rules in a while, but I've been teaching the game for a long time, you're not supposed to talk about your hand at all.
How do you keep track of the hit points of the monarchs?
Well, I use the app myself, so that's easier. But actually, that's a rule that I have gotten bad in the past, and I think other people have. While the Monarch is alive, all of the cards that you have played, you should keep on the play area. You should not put them in the discard pile yet. And I think a lot of players play the card and put it immediately in the discard pile, which would allow you to use a heart to reshuffle. You're not supposed to do that. And that's how you actually keep track of the Monarch's hit points, by just looking at the cards that you have played.
Huh. Yeah, we also use the app. And even though like the rest of the game is very elegant, meaning that, you know, it's just a deck of cards, and it's just, you are just thinking to yourself that why did it take this long for someone to invent this game?
Yeah.
But the hit point management is the part where I kind of feel like the elegance falls a little bit, because it's kind of like, it's this small speed bump that prevents you just playing this game of cards where just everyone's like slamming down the cards and like bringing down this Monarch.
Yeah.
You have to stop and be like, no, okay, let's now reduce the hit points of this Monarch.
Yeah. But like, do you think with the app it's still like cumbersome, or is it like without the app?
Without the app, it's definitely cumbersome. Yeah. With the app, it's much less cumbersome, but there is still this kind of like break in the flow. Mm-hmm. However, this is like a very minimal complaint.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's like a little bit break in the flow. But if you're playing with the beautiful cards, you don't mind that much. They look amazing. You're just like touching the app. The app has the same images. It's very easy to match. Like, oh yeah, I played this one or I played that one. So fantastic game. The Legacy version came out in Kickstarter last year, I think, or earlier this year. I wanted to pledge to that, but it was over 100 euros to just pledge for a seemingly simple game, just made more cumbersome. And I was like, is it worth more than 100 euros for Regicide, or is the enjoyment of Regicide the fact that it's so simple and nice? So I didn't end up pledging, but something I don't know why I wanted to mention in the podcast. And that is Regicide from 2020.
Scud Apres and The Anarchy are the two latest games from Garfield Games. Luis, what's your experience with Garfield Games?
In general, I think they have become quite complex, but I think they are good games. Well, I think Architects of the West Kingdom, which is the one that I played the most, I think it's like simple and complex, at least that it makes a robust engine without that much complexity in rules. And there's still like enough cards to make the variety of the game like quite interesting. I don't know. You always put me in the spot like this.
No, I think your commentary probably falls very much in line with other people's commentary on Garfield Games. Something I would add to that, I guess Garfield Games are known for games that also tend to be very low on player interaction.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just like very much focused on optimizing your own actions and engines. Raiders of Scythia and Hadrian's Wall are two Garfield games that me and Chilla have enjoyed a lot. I have played Architects of West Kingdom online. That one I didn't care that much for.
Mm.
But Raiders and Hadrian's Wall, those have been hits at our household. The Anarchy is basically the sequel to Hadrian's Wall. And since Hadrian's Wall was such a big hit for me and Chilla, I knew I wanted to get The Anarchy as soon as it came out. Scud Apres seemed like a fun game too, so I thought, you know, what the heck, and got that one as well. So let's talk a little bit about what these two games are alike. First of all, both of these games are textbook examples of multiplayer solitaire. There is barely any interaction in these games. It's just you doing your own thing with your resources and tracks. You don't look at what your opponent is doing at all. At the end, you simply see who got the highest score, shake hands, and congratulate the winner. So, why even play these types of games with other people? I like a good efficiency puzzle if I'm at home and I just want to relax. Some people would go for video games in these situations, but I don't do video games, so I look for these experiences in board games instead. And even though there isn't any interaction in these games, it's still a pretty alright way of spending time with your partner, especially if you compare it to both of you just killing time on your phones on the couch or whatever.
Mm.
So I can't really criticize the lack of interaction in Scud Apres or The Anarchy, because it's not even something that I need there to be in the first place. These games are a light weekday activity, and that's that. Okay, let's start with The Anarchy, which is the spiritual sequel to Hadrian's Wall. The Anarchy and Hadrian's Wall are over-the-top roll and writes. There's two big sheets of tracks and boxes that you fill out, and bunch of physical resources that you spend to advance on these tracks to get more resources from the supply. I think it takes like a solid 30 minutes to teach the game, but the good thing is that once you learn the game, you rarely look at the rulebook. Didn't you, Louis, say that these games shouldn't even be called Roll and Rights?
I did. It's like, I think people talk about it like Roll and Rights or Berv and Write, like Flip and Write, like cards. This has nothing to do with that. I think there's an element of luck in Roll and Rights where you are doing something every turn based on what you get. Here is more like a conversion engine optimization. It's like you get something, yes, at the start of your turn, which is a little bit luck-based. But other than that, most of the turn is just like, how do I convert to this and this and this and this to that and this to that, which doesn't feel like a roll and write besides the fact that you're marking something on a sheet.
Yeah, I agree. The experience is much closer to a heavy efficiency puzzle than your typical roll and write, even though, yeah, you are writing things down. Hadrian's Wall has gotten a lot of love, especially from solo players. It's such a unique game, given its form factor, that I couldn't tell anyone that they might like Hadrian's Wall if they like X. Because I honestly don't know what the X should be.
Yeah.
Like, if someone would tell me that if you like tracks, you should check out Hadrian's Wall, because it's tracks on tracks on tracks. But that would make me actually less interested in the game, because I generally don't like tracks in the games. But I really like Hadrian's Wall. So, you know, I don't know what I should say for the listener to assess whether The Anarchy or Hadrian's Wall is for them. Louis, how would you sell Hadrian's Wall to someone?
I wouldn't. So, listen, before you said the nice things about the puzzle and spending time with your partner and like a light weekend activity, which I was like about to challenge, like, is it really light? I was ready to like dump on these games. Like, we just recently played The Anarchy and I played Hadrian's Wall before, and I want to play with you to like try to figure out why it's so cool, because I have not enjoyed either of these experiences that much. I love Roll and Write, and that's why I got Hadrian's Wall in the first place, because I got sold in the idea that this is like a heavy Roll and Write. But it felt too heavy, and heavy enough that it made me frustrated about like, what am I playing wrong? And maybe I haven't played enough times to like get good at it, which you have complained before that I just have to get good at some of these things. But it just felt that, yeah, it's too complex for what it is. And then it's like, it would be a hard sell. Like, somebody needs to play it once and see whether or not they like it, because otherwise it would be really hard to sell to someone, even if you like an efficiency puzzle. It's like there is extra elements, like in The Anarchy, defending the wall and stuff, that kind of break that efficiency, like add a little bit of luck that is not nice towards somebody that would maybe enjoy more of an efficiency puzzle. And I remember kind of like Hadrian's Wall feeling similar, but I haven't played in a long time, so I would not be able to say for sure. But yeah, I wouldn't, but I heard you when you said that it's a nice experience. So I'm like, hey, maybe he's onto something.
Yeah, talking about like trying out this game somewhere, Hadrian's Wall is on Board Game Arena, so you could try it out there. But I have actually tried it out there just for fun and see how it is to play on a browser. And I have to say, it's like so dull. The thing that gets me into the flow state when playing Hadrian's Wall is the tactility of handling the wooden resources and ticking things with your pen and seeing all the sheets in front of you. And, you know, moving those resources to different piles by yourself to kind of remind yourself that this stone is for that track and that soldier is for that other track over there, because there's a lot of things that you need to manage. And none of that stuff is there in a digital environment, which means that Board Game Arena might not be a great place to give Hadrian's Wall a go. Dice Tower had maybe like something similar to say about The Anarchy that you did, Louis. They liked The Anarchy much less than Hadrian's Wall. And me and Sheila, we saw the Dice Tower review before I played my first game of The Anarchy. And it really set the expectations low for me for the game.
Mm.
But now, having played The Anarchy 5 times, I'm actually really questioning the Dice Tower review. Like, I believe that they did not enjoy the game the same way, Louis, that you did not enjoy the game that much. But my big question is, did they not enjoy the game because they did badly at it?
Mm.
You know, which is always an interesting question, because, you know, maybe you don't want the game to always be easy on the first go, especially a game like The Anarchy for solo players. You want that challenge, and you might want to get like 20 plays out of it and play the solo campaign. So I kind of wanted to address some of the Dice Tower's criticism and how I personally see those things. The first hang-up they had was the mini-games. So compared to Hadrian's Wall, The Anarchy has a lot more mini-games where you flip cards to get specific symbols or numbers, and you can get some really bad draws with these cards. And if you get those bad draws, you might feel like you just wasted a resource or an action and you get nothing out of it. Here's my defense. These mini games happen primarily in the entertainment section, meaning Like it's one of those tracks on one of the sheets. This means that you will unlock most of the mini games as you move on the entertainment track. And you don't need to build anything to play these mini games. So to me, it feels like you get to play these mini games almost for free. And therefore, if I get a little bit unlucky, it still feels that I got enough out of them.
Mm.
Did you try those mini games?
I did, but I actually think at least two of the mini games are in the, what is it, the church track,
mm-hmm.
the one with the knights and the husbandry, or like getting people married.
Yes.
And there I do agree that it felt like I was wasting a resource sometimes because you could get a bad draw and be like, oh, well, I could have gotten something better. It's not, I did not get something, but I could have gotten better if I had gotten better draws. So that was a little bit. And there I had to pay to build some of those things.
That is true. Yeah. But even like knight's training is like you spend one gray worker to get one blue worker, which is already like a nice conversion. And then if you get lucky, you might get one extra red worker as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Second hang up that Dice Tower had was the game length. Me and Chilla play Hadrian's Wall in under an hour. And the Anarchy is currently closer to a 2-hour game for me. Mm-hmm. I think my latest game was now 90 minutes. But we have played tons of Hadrian's Wall, so I can't compare the play times, you know, 1-to-1. And yes, even though the Anarchy might get even faster than my previous play, I'm still guessing that the play time for Anarchy is at least 30 minutes more compared to Hadrian's Wall. And this is because you get more resources at the start of the round, which means you will do much more conversions on your turn, which means your turns will take longer. And the new attack phase takes much longer compared to the attack phase of Hadrian's Wall. Which brings me to the third hang-up, which was the attack phase. So Hadrian's Wall had this super simple attack phase where you would draw X amount of cards from the deck, which told you which side of your wall, left, center, or right, your enemies attack, and then you just had to hope that you had built the defenses on those walls. In the Anarchy, you are now building walls, towers, gates, and moats that will defend against different types of attacks. And some of these attacks you will see beforehand and some not. I did not do good with the attacks in my first play, but I have now learned to kind of build some defenses early on and have extra soldiers and these tactic points to deal with surprise attacks from other sides. And figuring this stuff out has been super fun, and the attack part is now like one of my favorite things in the game. What did you think about the attack?
Yeah, it was frustrating. To like not know like where the attacks were coming from and maybe not have the resources to be able to defend most of the attacks. And if you didn't defend just two attacks in a round of with six attacks, that was already very punishing for the negative points versus the positive points. So that felt a little bit like, ugh, why am I spending all of this time to try to defend against attacks and I will still not know exactly where the attacks are coming from? But I can see what you're saying. Like if you have more flexibility, more knowledge, more the tactic points, and you can maybe do better.
Yeah, I'm nodding here at the studio because my first play also got me thinking that, wow, these attacks are really hard. And I guess you just get unlucky sometimes and they just, you know, the enemies come through and you lose all of these points. But yeah, you know, I think there is a skill in managing those attacks. So I personally think the Anarchy, I think it's a great sequel to Hadrian's Wall. I have even seen some people who didn't like Hadrian's Wall that much liking the Anarchy more. So if you enjoyed the solo campaign of Hadrian's Wall, I'm sure you will enjoy the Anarchy. Like it has like a full proper solo campaign. Hadrian's Wall had like a solo campaign that you could download online. But there's just like so much more in the Anarchy. And I just feel like there's new mechanics that you can discover and so much more exploring to do. So if you haven't played Hadrian's Wall, but you're somewhat interested in a solo or complete multiplayer solitaire efficiency puzzle, then I think you should give the Anarchy a shot. But the thing is that it might be the best thing for your brain or the worst thing for your brain. And I honestly don't know how you could reliably suss that out before playing the game a couple of times. So I don't know if I can give a recommendation for the game, but I will give you my blessing if you want to add it to your shopping cart. That was the Anarchy. Now let's talk about Scarabray. Scarabray is a worker placement game where you are placing workers only on your personal action spaces. So there's no central action board. There is this card draft between rounds, which is the only moment of interaction, and even that one feels like this accidental interaction instead of purposeful blocking. Scarabray plays in 4 rounds. Every round consists of 3 turns during which you get to assign all of your workers. You start with 1 worker and you get 1 extra worker in every round. There's nothing special happening with the workers. The action spaces let you move on 2 scoring tracks, collect resources and convert resources to other resources. You know, your basic worker placement resource management stuff. The twist of Skyrapray is your personal warehouse where you have to keep all your resources. On your player board, you have a grid of 33 spaces. Every time you get a resource, you have to put it in that grid. Now here's the thing. Between the rounds, you will get midden or trash. I did not know what the word midden meant before playing Skyrapray, but it means trash. You must place the midden in this same grid with your other resources. And the more stuff you have in your grid, the more trash you will get, which obviously will result to even more trash in later rounds. So the game is very much about A, finding the best ways to convert your resources to different things, but then B, doing it so that you always keep a very lean inventory of things, because otherwise you will spiral with your trash. And this central puzzle is super fun. Our games tend to take 60 minutes or so. Me and Chilla have played it 5 times now, and I can see another 5 games in the future. But I don't know if there's going to be 20 more plays here. The puzzle seems fairly easy to figure out, and the only variability comes from this extra action space that every player gets to pick at the start of the game. There's 8 unique extra action spaces, and while these extra action spaces do shake things up and force you to approach the game differently, the core puzzle seems very similar from game to game. So, just like the Anarchy, I really struggled to give Skyrapray a full recommendation, because the game is great, but it's absolutely no Agricola or Nusfjord. But it is super fun to play. So I'm personally very happy that I got the game, and I feel I'm getting my money's worth, but I have no idea where this game will be by the end of the year. It might get sold, it might stay in the collection, who knows. But no matter what happens to it, I'm pretty sure that me and Chilla can say that we had fun with it. Luis, how does this sound to you? Do you have any desires to play Skyrapray?
No, I have no desire to play Skyrapray. But I'm happy to hear that there's 5 more plays for you in the future, and good luck with that.
What makes this non-appetizing to you?
Well, you know that I hate the design of these games. Like, I don't like
And you mean the visuals, right?
I don't like the visuals of these games, like the art. I really find like it's too realistic for me. Like it just, I don't know why, I just don't like these particular illustrations. And that puts me off already, knowing that also like it's a multiplayer solitaire. It's like, well, I can play other games. But I wanted to ask you, that love this type of games, have you played Legacy of You?
No, I haven't. I remember when it came out, I was kind of like eyeing at it, since it was a solo game set in the same series. I think it's called the Ancients series. Yeah, same art. By the way, me and Chilo, we love the art.
Yeah, I know. You like realistic art. I don't love it that much.
But one other thing I want to say about the Skyrapray art. So not necessarily complaints about the style of the art, but some of these people in Skyrapray, which is this kind of like Stone Age Scottish settlement, some of these people are pretty jacked up. I think there is a gym somewhere on the island.
All right.
And since you mentioned Legacy of You, let me talk about solo play and Skyrapray. Don't get Skyrapray for solo play. I don't think it has legs for rewarding solo gaming. I think it's just like a little too light compared to how little variability there is between plays and how fast you will probably be able to crack the puzzle. I mean, we are 5 games in and I feel like we have already kind of like learned the ropes and like how to do this resource management stuff.
Got it.
That was Skyrapray by Shem Phillips. And by the way, the Anarchy was from Bobby Hill. Our main topic of today is winning and friendship. Luis, do you prefer competitive games over cooperative games? And do you have more fun when you are winning versus losing?
Those are two very complex questions. Like, there's so many great cooperative games that I would prefer sometimes over competitive games. But I think in general, the vast majority of my board game experience is competitive games. And I enjoy that quite a lot. So if I have to choose, yeah, I think I prefer competitive games. And yes, for sure, 100%, I think I enjoy the game more when I'm winning than when I'm losing. Not that I don't enjoy it when I'm losing, but I think it's a feeling of elation that I get when like, oh yeah, I'm gonna win.
So I have been reading this academic article from the journal Computers in Human Behavior. And the article is titled, The Influence of Competitive and Cooperative Video Games on Behavior During Play and Friendship Quality in Adolescence. I wish I would have the printed article now to show you, Luis, so you can just kind of see that, okay, this is the real thing. Mm-hmm. The printer did not work today, so I just have to, I'm making gestures here about like with my hands.
Yeah, and I'm imagining
gesture of like
perfectly.
A4 paper.
Thank you for the article. I can see it in my mind now.
Yeah. So in this study, the researchers took a bunch of teenagers who were friends with each other, like previous to the study. These were not strangers to each other. And the researchers studied the interactions and experiences of these people during and after playing Mario Kart Double Dash, either competitively or cooperatively. Mario Kart is a super popular racing game. I know almost nothing about the game, although I have played some versions of Mario Kart a couple of times. But in Mario Kart Double Dash, you can play cooperatively by having two riders on the same kart. Have you done this?
No,
have you ever double carted?
I have never double carted, no.
Okay, so one player drives the cart and the other player controls the items. And I will now admit that I have no idea what this controlling of the items means. To me, it just sounds like so much more boring compared to driving the cart. But hey, what do I know?
Yeah.
Okay, and of course, you know, this is a board game podcast. The research is done on video games, but I think there's like a lot of things that we can also learn,
yeah,
you know, regarding board games. So studying these kinds of things is very difficult, or like the effects of games to friendships, because obviously a 15-minute game session is not going to change anyone's friendship. Although, now that I said that, I can imagine that there has probably been plenty of 15-minute game sessions that have really hurt friendships.
Yeah.
All right. But the researchers acknowledge this limitation, and even though the study doesn't have any uncontestable findings, you know, everything, the researchers also say that, you know, basically everything we say here, take it with a grain of salt. You know, this is just one study. But despite all of this, I think there might be some interesting observations for us to discuss. So I'm going to ask you, Louis, different questions about winning and competition, and then kind of talk more about this paper as we go.
All right.
Louis, is your behavior different at the table when you are playing a competitive or cooperative game?
Yeah, I think it's different. I think when you're playing a competitive game, you're more secretive. You're keeping to yourself, thinking in your head, like focusing on the strategies that you want to do. Maybe a little bit more silent, focusing the game. Cooperative, well, there's more interaction because you have to talk to people. Obviously, depending on the game, you might not be able to talk, like what we said in Regicide, but still, like, I think maybe you're more open, you're more like interacting with other people, etc. So I think for sure, depending on the game, but it changes the interaction levels.
And when you are interacting in a competitive game, or let's say in a cooperative game, are you a more friendlier person in a cooperative game and a meaner person when playing a competitive game?
I don't think I'm a meaner person, no. I think like because I also play a lot with different type of people. I want to win many times, especially if I'm playing against you and other friends from our group, which like maybe we're a bit more competitive and we play enough and often together that it's like the interactions are a bit different. But when we're playing with other people, maybe you're like trying to get them into the hobby or teaching them a game, like you want them to have a good time. I personally don't feel that I'm any meaner, maybe even nicer when I'm playing a competitive game sometimes. And with you guys, with you and the rest of our group, it's like more bantering, maybe more nasty in that way, but not necessarily mean.
So the researchers observed that when the players played the competitive version of Mario Kart versus the cooperative version of Mario Kart, there was actually no difference in the amount of communication observed. So you, Louis, said that, you know, you might talk more in a cooperative game, and that can be true. But these researchers found, like, okay, if you study multiple people, you see that the amount of communication doesn't actually change. If you are playing a competitive or a cooperative game. However, the nature of the interactions do change. Let me introduce you to the child-friend interaction rating scale that the researchers used as the basis of their observations. Bear with me here.
Okay.
So let's talk about individual behavior. The individual behavior we can categorize to positive, negative, dominant, submissive, or competitive behavior. Positive behavior is, you know, helping, thanking someone. Negative behavior is being intrusive or hostile. Mm-hmm. Dominant means that you are bossy. You are influencing or controlling the play.
Mm-hmm.
Submissive means that you are complying with others, seeking direction or approval. Competitive is basically teasing or taunting. Maybe that banter that you were referring to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition to individual behavior, you have this kind of like dyadic behavior. So dyadic, another word that I have learned, it just refers to like behavior between two people. Dyadic means kind of like two things. So the types of dyadic behavior are positive connectedness, prosocial behavior, quantity of communication, disharmony, conflict, and imbalance of power. Positive connectedness, that is this explicitly pleasant, nice, and considerate behavior toward each other. Prosocial behavior is dyadic cooperation, mutual thanking, and complimenting. Quantity of communication is basically the frequency of verbal communication regardless of content or tone. And this did not change between competitive or cooperative play. The disharmony means non-mutual, non-reciprocal interaction, interrupting each other. Conflict is disagreement, aversive interchanges. Imbalance of power is unequal distribution of dominance slash leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So, cooperative gaming, would you have guessed that it had more positive behavior?
Now that you ask like that, I would say no, more negative.
That's probably not surprising that cooperative gaming has more positive behavior, which is this like helping and thanking, you usually do in cooperative gaming. But yes, cooperative gaming also had more negative behavior as well.
Yeah. You messed up. You didn't send it on time.
Exactly. Yeah. Competitive gaming can actually have a little bit more neutral communication, whereas like cooperative gaming seems to be either I'm thanking you or I'm telling you to like get the heck out.
Yeah.
Play better, Luis.
Yeah.
And then, the researchers also saw more dominant and submissive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So some person dominating the board and other players being like, well, okay, you tell me what to do and I'll do that.
Yeah, alpha gamer. The alpha gamer problem, right?
Yeah. You have probably seen this happen just at least to some extent somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about friendships next. So, Luis, has playing competitive games affected your friendship? And if it has the effect always been positive or has the effect sometimes been negative?
Well, I think in general, it has affected positively. I can imagine times where maybe some situations, if they got too stressful or something, that maybe complicated some relationships. But I think in general, they have affected positively. If I can remember, like, I think one time where somebody accused me of cheating or something, and I was definitely not cheating. That was one of the worst things that, and some friends know this story and then they just bother me with like, you're cheating. But I know they don't mean it. But I think one time, I think somebody like accused me, like it was a friend or like some random, and that was like a really bad experience because I'm like, I'm not, but they were sure I was, and I was sure I was not. But then there's like just a mismatch between realities. And that I think has been the worst experience or that in general, I think can be a really bad experience, both if you're cheating and if you're not cheating and somebody like accuses you like that those dynamics can be really bad. But in general, I would imagine that they're like affect positively. Like
the researchers tried to like see that, how do these 15-minute games of Mario Kart affect these friendships? And yeah, they didn't see much of a change, but they also say in the research paper that, hey, these friends knew each other and have played a lot together. So this one... additional 15-minute game is not going to make a change here. However, what they noticed was that the behavior that the two teenagers showed toward each other, it kind of like predicted how good the friendship was when they were tested afterwards of like how good their friendship is.
Okay.
If there was a lot of like pro-social behavior and positive behavior during the gameplay, it predicted that the friendship quality was also, better. So since the cooperative and the competitive gaming had also this kind of like same amount of communication and the cooperative gaming had a little bit more positive but also more negative behavior, mm-hmm. The researchers kind of said that, the focus shouldn't be like what type of a game you're playing, but more of like, okay, how are you interacting with each other? And the researchers, they said that, for example, game designers could take a lesson from this paper and add more elements to their game that can kind of like encourage this positive behavior. But when I read that part, I said out loud, no, like us players should be learn how to be like more pro-social. I don't want to have like more games that kind of like enforce me to now say thank you to Luis or compliment his fine move. But more like, hey, what type of an energy am I bringing to the table? And because again, with these type of things, you don't know what's causation and what is correlation.
Mm-hmm.
But I can kind of like, see that, hey, even if you don't have the best, relations with someone, if you start to acting like a little bit better with each other, that relationship is going to get better.
Right? Yeah.
Same thing, I feel like our friendships as well, but it's maybe a good reminder for like in the future game sessions to always kind of like, keep the fun things there in the interaction, even though we are like both trying to win and crush each other.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing that I find interesting, that maybe, which maybe is like besides the point or maybe tangential, is like, I think I can play board games with somebody that I don't like, whereas I cannot maybe have a conversation with them, or I don't want to have a conversation with them, where like, what I can, like, I can totally play a board game with like, yeah, let's just play. Like, and I'll be social and I'll be cordial and I'll be whatever. But if we're not playing a board game, I would rather not interact with them. So I think it can also be beneficial for the general atmosphere of a group or just to try to motivate those like positive changes. And maybe after the game, I will be like, hey, I thought I didn't like you, but now I like you or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I feel that oftentimes the advice to people who do not like competitive games is that, hey, you need to stop worrying about losing. You know, don't take it too seriously. You know, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
But after reading this paper and about this, like, the, you know, the observations in the behavior of people, it got me thinking that, hey, it's not just that the responsibility of the conflict averse person to, you know, like make the experience better, but, you know, everyone around the table mm-hmm. to make the, you know, experience better.
Yeah. I know a lot of people that like are really against competitiveness for different reasons, either because they don't like their own behavior during the competition and therefore they would rather avoid that, or because they just feel too anxious or too stressed about the competition or the fact that they need to win or to be the best. So I do find like there is a point to be made where like these people would not enjoy games or maybe would not play any games unless they were cooperative games. And they're okay with like trying to win the game as a team, but they're not so okay like to compete against other people for different multiple factors. So I can see having a goal to reach that is outside the social relationship, which is like, okay, we need to cooperate towards, that's the enemy, like something else. It's not us being beneficial for the hobby as a whole, at least just mentioning that.
Yeah. Luis, is competitive gaming good for you?
Yeah, 100%. I enjoy the puzzle. I enjoy the learning a new game and like trying to be good at the game and trying to like be good at like at what we're doing. Many times I don't achieve it. I lose. So it's good. And I think I've learned to just be like, hey, whatever. Like sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But of course, I always want to win. And I think without the fact that you want to win, then why are you kind of playing the game? If you're not playing to win, I think it takes something away from the experience. Like if three people are engaged and one person is kind of not really caring about their moves, it takes away from everybody's experience. So at least from the three players that are trying to win, and maybe it affects their probabilities of winning if somebody's just playing randomly or just playing like too crazy. Yeah, it nurtures my brain and gives me like some energy. And it's like, well, a kind of detached experience where hopefully I win, but if I don't, it's not good. But if I win, then the dopamine hit is quite nice, I think.
This research paper also referred to another research paper that had studied the effect of competitive gaming to children. It appears so that there is this kind of like big question of like, is competitive gaming good for kids?
Mm.
And, you know, if you apply certain models or certain theories, those theories would suggest that, you know, competitive gaming is not necessarily good for children, because it can increase frustration or aggression. There was this one longitudinal study of children, meaning that they studied, you know, the same kids over multiple years and looked at, okay, what type of games did they play and how did they grow up? You know, what type of challenges did they have socially? And they found this link between competitive gaming and beneficial effects, quoting, such as decrease in contact problems and improvement in peer relations. However, the researchers didn't really know, like, why is it so? Like, what is the thing with competitive gaming that, you know, has this effect? One theory that they discussed was that competitive games have actually like a pretty diverse range of social interaction. Because if you have, like, multiple people around a table, the social interaction is not just that, hey, I need to win this game. But there are moments where you need to make these like temporary alliances, right?
Mm-hmm.
Someone is doing too good and we combine our forces to coordinate to win, mm-hmm. right? Or me and my neighbor, we just agreed that, hey, we don't fight against each other. Let's help each other out and let's see who wins, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is this kind of like cooperation even in competitive gaming, right? And like, this was not discussed in the research paper, but... I immediately start also thinking, like, how much of this is this kind of like survivorship bias? It's not fun to play with people who, when they are winning, they just kind of like gloat it over you. Or mm-hmm. when you make a bad move, they just call you an idiot or something like that, mm-hmm. right? And I'm just wondering, like, in your life, if you don't end up playing a lot of competitive games. This is because like a lot of people just don't enjoy playing competitive games with you.
Yeah. Yeah, it might be. And I can totally see how if a kid also plays competitive games, they can, again, and I don't know anything about child psychology, so I'm just, but they can learn how to react to emotions that winning or losing create, right? You can learn to deal with defeat and with losing more often. And of course, if it happens, if you play enough competitive games while you're a kid, then you learn both, because hopefully you're not going to lose every game. And hopefully you're not going to win every game, so that there's like, it helps you deal with those situations better, which can, I think, in the long term also help you deal with different relationship situations and at work, maybe how to deal with negative feedback or how to deal with positive feedback, how to not be a bad person when you feel like somebody else is doing a bad move in life or a bad move at work or something like that. And for sure, if you are not a good winner or not a good loser, people would not want to play with you.
I actually like often struggle to enjoy two-player head-to-head games. And now, after reading this study, my thinking is that it actually might be because there is like much less diversity in the social aspect in two-player head-to-head games, right? Like, you do not make any alliances in a two-player game, right? It is like really head-to-head. You can still have this like positive behavior, you know, like commenting each other's move, like, hey, you really screwed me over there. Mm-hmm. And what a great move, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. Now I'm just like kind of thinking that maybe my like small minor anxieties with two-player head-to-head games is just regarding that like there's like no social element there, or like there is a social element there. It's just not as big as it is with like multiplayer competitive games. And therefore, I don't get like a big part of the gaming or like the big part of the gaming is missing from me. Does this resonate with you? Do you have like, have you had similar experiences?
Not entirely. I actually enjoy two-player games quite a lot. I'll tell you a story. Like we were playing with one of my best friends. We were playing Seven Wonders Duel quite a lot. But at some point, and we were kind of playing together and we learned the game together and we kind of had the same level of either good or badness, the same level of play, where at some point, like winning or losing started become too stressful because like we were like, okay, I really want to win because I lost already last time or I lost the last two. And also because it was just fun and stuff, like we were bantering quite a lot when we won. We were not being the best winner. And then we were lose, we would not be the best loser. So I think we had to get out of the game for a little bit and chill out and maybe we even had a discussion like, hey, maybe let's try not to for like the next few games, like not try to be too nasty on the other when we play. And that, I think, helped quite a lot reduce the stress levels because it started becoming too important to win in those games. So I can definitely see that applied to maybe other interactions, other relationships can be like stressful. It can be like feel anxiety inducing if you want to win or if you're like, if the competitiveness of the game is like really there. So for sure, I see that. And then having more people, it can kind of spread that stress towards like, oh, well, this time this person went, so it's fine. But this person is not winning all the time. And I didn't win. But in a two-player game, if you don't win, the other player is winning. So if you don't win three times in a row, it's like, damn. And it can take a hit. I think the ego can take a hit a little bit. Because while I don't mind losing, I think do feel it when I've not won in a while. It's like, damn, like I haven't won in a while.
And I think that is still a big part of it for me as well. You know, like that, okay, I can handle losing three games in a row in a two-player game. I can even handle losing 5 or 10 if I know that there is this big experience gap, you know, and I'm just like learning the game, for example. But if it's just you and your friend and you feel that you're on equal footing and your friend just beats you 10 games in a row, you kind of like... Like no matter how much you're able to distance yourself from that game, you still kind of like there is like a small pain inside you.
Yeah, for sure. Never happened 10 in a row, but it was like just like I need to win. This is the next one. But then when you had a victory under your belt, it's like it doesn't matter if I win the next one or
exactly.
not.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's maybe that's a good place to finish. I think when you are winning, the losing doesn't matter. You know, when you are the winner, hey, who cares if you lose?
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes when you're losing, you view losing a little bit differently. Okay. That was it. That was our deep dive into winning and friendship in the academia of video games. Hope you learned something from it. Hope it got you thinking about winning and, you know, your personal relationship with it and your, how does your game group deal with winning and losing? And, you know, what is the behavior in your game group? Maybe that's something you want to think about. Okay, hey, but we want to thank you for your time. Our next episode is airing in 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can visit boardgameok.com for more information about the show.
Bye-bye, okay?